Financial degenerates, what's going on? This is the QTR podcast. I am QTR. It is Halloween. And on this Halloween, I would like to remind you that Edgar Allan Poe drank so much that the front of his face actually fucking fell off his head. Don't quote me on that. All right. This podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that donate a monthly recurring sum that helps support the podcast. They're listeners that want to pitch in and want to do their part, and I appreciate that shit because, as I said on Twitter yesterday, this podcast is 100% run and creatively controlled by me, and all these fucks that keep trying to invest in the podcast and I keep turning them down, they're baffled. You know why? Because I don't want to give up 1% of the content or the creative control. I want to just be able to do what I'm doing now, which is have fun. So my patrons allow me to do that. Thank you guys so much. I'm going to shout out some of my patrons, and then we're going to get on with my two rules for life in general, and then we'll get on to the interview. First and foremost, this podcast is brought to you by my friends over at the Sanlucci Steam Room. My boys over at Sanlucci, they do a couple of things. First and foremost, they follow big money coming into the options market that helps them telegraph where moves in the equities market are going to happen. They are on top of this stuff 24/7 daily, putting it in the Sanlucci Steam Room, which is a chat room that you can sign up for and get access to all this shit as soon as it happens. So that is how Sanlucci and his merry band of brothers have been successful over the last couple of years. They have also used a couple of other strategies that they've laid out in something called the 3LT Playbook, which lays out several of Lucci's strategies that he used to become a seven-figure trader. If you want to try out his service or you want to just check out Sanlucci in general, he is a friend of mine, as is his partner, Charlie Bathgate. Their links are in the podcast description. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a service for day traders. It includes daily watch lists, daily live streams, investor education. These guys trade in green markets. They trade in red markets. They trade with options. They trade with stocks. They pretty much do it all. The only thing they don't do is they don't fuck with low float garbage. They're not going to waste your time with that. Pete from the Trader's Path emailed me yesterday, said that they're offering a free trial until November 13th. So no charge, no credit card needed, no obligation, none of that happy horse shit. Check it out at thetraderspath.com. And there's a link also to the Trader's Path in my podcast description. Good guy over there, Mr. Pete H. All right, this podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Rumorhound. Rumorhound is a brand new piece of AI-based software that is going to help you sort through a lot of the merger and acquisition rumors that pop up on a daily basis. Hey, we just saw a couple of them over the last couple of days with Fitbit and a couple other names I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's always rumors and they're generally about mergers and acquisitions. Rumorhound takes all of this information and a bunch of variables like where the source came from, what the company's financial status is, and a bunch of other proprietary variables, and it boils them down using AI to try and give you an edge as to which rumors are worth paying attention to and which ones are not. If you're a day trader, it's worth your time to check out Rumorhound. The link is in the podcast description. Could be another great tool to add to your daily toolbox. My friends over at Focused Compounding also support the podcast. What is Focused Compounding? It's a bunch of guys who focus on trying to get the sponsorship shit right. But when you hiccup in the middle of a sentence, it doesn't fucking work. That's not it. The guys over at Focused Compounding focus on little niches of the market where analysts aren't, where traders aren't. They're looking for trade ideas that nobody else has found yet. So you can check them out at FocusedCompounding.com. There's a link to them in the podcast description. But you can also check out their free ideas on their Twitter account, at Focused Compound. Not Focused Compounding, at Focused Compound. Check them out because they put a lot of shit up there for free. And the best thing is you don't have to buy anything. You can just follow them and be cool with them. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Hella Bacon. Bunch of guys in Texas shooting machine guns out of helicopters. My friends at Corvus Gold. My friend Monero. Jay Mintzmyer. Russ Valenti. Some of my good friends. Matthew Zimmer. Thanks for sticking with me, brother. I'm sure things are getting a little crazy in your world. You know what I'm talking about. I know what I'm talking about with you. We'll leave it to that. Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud over at Investors Underground and Traders for a Cause, Chris Bede, Ken R, Chris Boas, Ken, and Mr. J.K. Cunningham. I appreciate your continued support. You too, Stank Love, and Brainerd Ferguson, Matt Merle, and Sam Pearson. I still see you guys. Some of my older patrons, guys like Ethan Parker and Peter Roselle, M&M Research, I appreciate you guys sticking with me. The Invisible Hand Job is still in the house. Anthony and Avi Geller, thank you, my friend. What's going on, Avi? Wolfgang Pippinger, Rock That Frog, Mike Tashieri. Appreciate you guys very much for sticking with me. My friends over at the Tesla Q podcast, still supporting. Man, I got a bunch of news that I can't tell you guys about, but stay tuned for podcasts over the next couple months is all I'm going to say. All right, fuck that stuff for now. I got a little something working today. First and foremost, ladies and gentlemen, it's got to be probably 5-6 o'clock in your world right now by the time you're listening to this today. Why don't you settle in and crack open a couple of cold ones? We'll make our way through this podcast together. 2-drink minimum. That's the rule for these podcasts. I've been saying it since day one, and I'm never going to stop saying it, and I will adjust for inflation as drinks become weaker and weaker, and as your guys' tolerance for alcohol continues to increase, I will be making hedonic adjustments to the drink minimum at some point. Finally, this podcast is not investing advice. Don't listen to me, and don't listen to Jeff Mackey. As a matter of fact, Jeff Mackey doesn't want you to listen to him so much, he just said, fuck it, I'm never going back on CNBC again, and, well, I was never invited in the first place. So there you go. I hold no registrations, no licenses, and we are only talking about our own investments. Do not take this as investing advice. All right. Sorry. I have Jeff Mackey here. I just said to Jeff, I fucking lost your bio. I don't know what I had a thing here I was going to read to introduce you, Jeff. And you're like, yeah, whatever. Fuck it. I'm Jeff Mackey. I'm 51.
Dude, by now, they either know me or they don't. It doesn't seem to matter what I say after that. So I'm good. Let's roll. Do we have topics? I'm good with anything. What do you want to talk about? I'm watching the crown jewel from Saudi Arabia, the WWE's pay-per-view, which the stock is down 17% or something because it turns out that this event is an abomination and they really should not be holding it at all.
Okay.
It's that kind of day.
The pay-per-view event is on now?
WWE kind of stashes these events in Saudi Arabia, and because they recognize that maybe the American appetite isn't that high for them, they always show them in the middle of work days. And so this is the crown jewel. They've got a Royal Rumble going on. Hulk Hogan's back. It's too soon for Hulk Hogan to be back, even in Saudi Arabia. They're just like, you know, Hulk Hogan?
Yeah. And this is on right now.
This is on right now. This is on right this second. That's the kind of world we live in. Right now, Roman Reigns is reaching frantically for the tag.
Are you are you an investor in WWE? Is that why you're watching?
I have been in the past. They've actually got incredible networks. WWE, they went off the pay-per-view grid and onto apps years ago. They've been streaming for years. And so when Disney talks about it like it's this Mars landing, Vince McMahon's crazy redneck ass just went out there and did this like almost 10 years ago at this point. They went away from pay-per-views, which were basically all of WWE's revenues, not in-house show. And, you know, it was their blood money. It's WWE, man. WrestleMania was how pay-per-view came to be, and they dumped it to go for subscription apps. And, you know, it started off just the way you think. People signed up and they'd get on board for WrestleMania and then they'd let it drop and not everyone would remember. But, you know, the subs kind of balanced out. And as an investment, when people realized the app was going to work, the stock just went absolutely parabolic. They started doing stuff like this. The event I'm watching right now, WWE's probably getting paid $50, $75 million for holding it in, you know, Saudi Arabia because they're the WWE and they don't have problems with things like that. But, you know, it's super high margin, not going to last forever. And they started doing them, I think, right around the exact same time the stock peaked at 100. So I'm kind of just watching it for the gallows.
Well, they have a lot of money out there and they love spectacles. I was just reading a article like 4 days ago that they're building a in the middle of the fucking desert. I don't know if it's in Saudi Arabia or if it's like in Dubai or I think it is in Dubai. They've sectioned off 10 square miles and they're going to build a a snow town in the, because there's really no better way to do that than to select what is possibly the hottest place on the face of the earth. The temperatures there are like 100 degrees year round, and they're like, oh, we're gonna make a snow park here with skiing and snowboarding and snow tubing. And it's like, all right, so they have that kind of money. We're like, nobody in that discussion, Jeff, says like, isn't this gonna require some resources?
But no one gives a shit. It's the only people for whom holding these events really makes economic sense. I mean, they're going to hold a big UFC event at Madison Square Garden this weekend, and it's probably going to have a $10 million live gate, and it's going to be a huge deal. But man, if you want just sick cash flow, you go back to the old days when Don King was letting basically flat-out dictators hold these fights because they love the spectacle. It's the same reason that the commie nations and the former commie nations all have the Olympics now. Because who the hell wants the Olympics? We got them in L.A. I'm 75 miles away from where the Olympics are going to be in L.A., and I can't get far enough away. I may just swim for it when they come here because it's that bad to have them. They make no economic sense anywhere except in a dictatorship. So, you know. WWE, they're carnies, basically, and there's always been a huge McMahon discount in the stocks because they're kind of shameless about it. You know, the whole family's in on the gig. They've all done just tremendously kind of non-executive seeming things as part of the gimmick, and they don't really see the difference. Vince McMahon and the guy he plays on TV are essentially the same person right now, which makes following the company just an absolute blast. Because he's just like Mr. Kiss My Ass on the conference calls. They barely let him do them at this point. But, you know, it makes the stock tough.
Yeah, he seems like a raging hard-on. I don't know a lot about WWF or WWE, sorry. They just changed the name 20 years ago, forgive me.
World Wildlife Fund has no claim on that name, Jack. They should have fought it out in a steel cage. It would have raised millions of dollars. The panda and Hulk Hogan, that's who Hulk Hogan could fight, a bear. But it's people would pay to see that. Now, this has been the media stock. You don't watch these companies for the sick thrill of men in tights. You watch them because this told you basically how over the top would look a really long time ago.
So you know, are you a WWE fan, though, like outside of it as an investment? Like, did you watch wrestling?
No, I'm what they call a lapsed fan, which are just steakheads who used to watch it back in the day. And you know, it's really the ultimate discretionary product for just a group of males, meaning, you know, if they've got a star, like The Rock came from WWE. The Rock can work a mic. Guys are either charismatic or they're not. And right. So when The Rock was doing it, it was awesome. You know, right now they don't have anybody awesome, so they'll figure it out. But it's always been an incredibly cyclical business, usually with the economy, actually.
It's weird to look back at pro wrestling now because I watched it as a kid, and then I grew out of it. I stopped watching it maybe at like, probably by the time I got into college, I definitely stopped watching it. But I remember being in college and watching a bunch of the old, like, by that point they had kind of given up on trying to charge for some of the older, like, WrestleManias and shit like that. And, you know, some of my fraternity brothers had gotten all the WrestleManias on DVD bootleg or something, and I remember watching them then. I was like, all right, this is kind of amusing. And then probably maybe 5 years ago, I looked up a bunch of clips on YouTube trying to see if there would be any big happenings at like WrestleMania or something that I would remember from being a kid. There really wasn't. But the one thing that baffled me was, and really, you know, to speak to the pageantry of it and the entertainment of it all, is I couldn't believe how long the narratives and the shit talking and the introductions and the, you know, people exiting stage and the people coming in out in the middle of the match and the fucking ref's got a problem and the announcers are involved. It was like 2 minutes of actual wrestling, and then it was just like 28 minutes of just like crazy, like steroid-induced human growth hormone soap opera.
Oh, yeah. Hulkster used to take a few bumps right out of his title belt. Rumor has it, anyway, according to shoot interviews. So it's a long and storied history of the guys going to the pharmaceuticals and getting a little pep. There's a, they, a little, they have a whole
a little pep. Have you ever seen Ric Flair?
Like yeah, Ric Flair.
There's a YouTube video that I've watched probably a million times like years ago. I'll never forget the title of it. It's called Best of Ric Flair Going Nuts. That's all it's called. And it's just, it's 15 years, 20 years, 25 years of this guy with his face fire engine red just looking into the camera on some kind of fucking adrenaline level, Jeff, that you and I, if we lived to be 100 and we took every drug in the book, couldn't even get close to.
You know what it is, Chris? He's got championship blood.
Oh, and yes.
He's got championship blood and the 10 pounds of gold and the alligator shoes that he just can't stop walking, baby.
Rolex wearing, kiss stealing,
but
wheeling,
hey,
and dealing.
You know what, what those guys got, what WWE has, first of all, no shame whatsoever. Utterly
correct.
Unencumbered by shame, which has been Vince's big advantage all along. And he's legit a hard ass. You know, it's a company full of big, huge, steroided up theatrical guys. So to
right.
be kind of the alpha dog of that is a big deal. But he financed it originally with junk debt. Back in the 80s, he levered that sumbitch up, bought it from his dad through WrestleMania, bet the house on it. Then he went IPO in 1999, same day as Martha Stewart. Vince McMahon took his company public. And Vince McMahon is still a public company. Martha Stewart is not. America will be long gone before wrestling even takes a hiccup. It is unkillable. There's just something theatrical about it. And you know, fans come and go. Someday you'll have a kid and you'll just be like, well, here's something generic and simulated violent we can watch together. It's WWE genuinely counts on people who are lapsed fans, and they can tell how well they're doing by how many of those people they lose. Guys like me who are on the margin. If they're telling a good story, I'm there. If it's a lame story, I really have better things to do.
Yeah, it's weird too. I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, I mean, but that's a consumer discretionary. That's a consumer tell. They showed us where the platform would be. They're out there on the literal bleeding edge of culture doing things that are uncomfortable for everybody else. Those companies are tells. And so, you know, and I love a company that people immediately give you shit if you're paying any attention to it whatsoever. And man, it's WWE. This fits the bill. This completely fits the bill. The fact that no one else is willing to watch wrestling tells me that I can have an informational edge there.
Well, and it's you know, it has solidified its place as entertainment too. I remember, you know, the 80s and the 90s, and you know, there was this controversy. Is it real? Is it not real? I mean, now it's widely accepted that it's not real, and proof that it has found that niche in entertainment is the fact that we have real fighting now happening. You know, like you mentioned the UFC event coming up on Saturday. I mean, that's going to be a real fight between two of the best welterweights in the world in terms of actual fighting. And yet their groups are kind of segmented. You know, you tune into a WWE match and the crowd looks a little bit different than a crowd at a UFC fight.
Yeah, it's like a gateway drug to UFC, basically. And UFC and boxing, they all kind of fill that primal void and that urge we have as a culture to kind of look at violence, which it's there, so there's no point denying it. So you might as well look at the numbers because they tell you something about where the consumer is. You know, people are buying this direct. They feel like they have disposable income. When people buy the fights, you know, how bad can society really be if you're paying $200 for a pay-per-view fight that may or may not be good? Yeah, it's. I talked to Dana White a long time ago. We interviewed him for Fastlane, and they were still sponsored by Mickey's Big Mouth. Mickey's freaking Big Mouth. That was a tough sell over in Inglewood Cliffs that this UFC stuff would be a big deal. But Dana White was like, we're going to put on the fights that people want to see, and it'll be huge.
Right.
Because unlike boxing, we're not going to dick around. We're going to have all the fighters' contracts, so they can't do that thing where they hold off too long and the guys fight when they're 40. Like, he just matched them up and made the fights and gave people what they wanted. Now, they've since sold out. You know, it'll run into its own problems, and there might be a little CTE associated with all these guys getting knocked unconscious all the time.
Might be.
Hey, the science isn't clear.
Yeah.
But, you know, but the, that, you know, ultimately, it's, they're going to stagger through. I mean, they're again, these are event type of things, and they created this BMF title belt, and they're going to have the thing in Madison Square Garden, and they're going to make freaking, you know, 50,
that's
60,
gonna be,
70.
Who knows? Good fight too.
They'll make scores of millions of dollars. It'll be a great fight. I'll be watching my kid. And that pay-per-view on-ramp, that business model that they're using for it, all started at WWE. Basically, in 6-7 years that it's taken the Disney Corporation to kind of replicate the pay-per-view model, all they added was monthly subs, and then you pay extra for the pay-per-views themselves. That's it. That's the only difference between what ABC and Disney is doing versus what WWE has been doing for a decade.
Do you watch boxing or do you watch UFC?
Oh, yeah. I watch all of them.
What's your preference?
You know, I'm an old boxing guy, but that I realize is not that interesting. So, you know, I mean, it's boxing can just be so slow. There's nothing better than a good boxing match, but man, you know, UFC is more reliably kind of combat oriented, and basically I'm just watching with my kid. So
well,
he's a UFC guy.
I'm more interested in boxing now than I've ever been, and that's just from hanging out at a gym, at an MMA gym the last couple of years. And you know, primarily I just train jiu-jitsu, which is grappling, but you know, I have, you know, taken boxing many times, and I've watched people at the gym box, and you know, watch some of the real fighters come out of our gym. By the way, November 14th, the podcast is sponsoring Sydney Outlaw, who's fighting for Bellator in Tel Aviv. That should be a badass fight. So Sid trains at our gym. He's a bad motherfucker. The point is, though, that, you know, I've got this appreciation for boxing that I never had before because I had never put on a pair of gloves before. So just a couple years ago, to put on a pair of gloves for the first time and just try to hold these 1 pound weights on your hands, and then just even hold your hands up, let alone
forget about
throwing a punch, forget about, you know, because I remember watching boxing, Jeff, and being like, it's 3 minutes, like, what the fuck are these guys so tired for, you know? And then then you go and actually spar, and you're like, wow, like, I get
it. And it feels like something's wrong with your shoulders. It's like I can't even extend my arm in a jab-like motion.
Oh, and you have no clue how to keep your weight back, how to move your hips, how to actually throw punches. So, you know, boxing took a huge hit when UFC come along, but a lot of UFC is boxing. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, and so you get a lot of guys that were former boxers that are now fighting in the UFC. You get guys that, you know, have kind of gone the other direction that were world-class grapplers that have had to learn how to box. And I don't know, for me, it's given me a new appreciation for boxing. So I can tune in and watch a boxing match now when I wouldn't have in the past.
Hey, you know, the I watch them with my kid, which just having teenagers kind of changes your perspective on everything. It actually makes you a better investor, so I sort of funnel through it a lot. But, you know, you see things through the fresh eyes that way. And what fighting sports have for all of their problems are that they teach kind of the whole point of what you want your kids to get out of athletics. Like, you know, a trained boxer knows how to do that, and they've conquered a significant amount of primal level fears just by squaring off with a kid, holding their hands up,
right,
learning how not to be afraid, how to stand in the pocket. That you know, of course it hurts to get hit, but you know, stop crying about it. The other guy's trying to hit you too. Just, you know, it's just sucking it up even when you're afraid. And as I'm constantly telling my kids, of course they're scared. They're about to swing and fight with another professional. You know, it's not brave if you're not afraid. You're just psychotic. You know, it's being afraid and actually standing in the pocket that you want the kids to learn with any of these competitions. And with fighting, that's what makes it so fascinating, is just that other world level of bravery that you have to have, the level of skill that it takes, and just, I mean, some of the just freakish coordination and outrageous moves that you see. Again, at its peak, and I get that it's not everybody's cup of Java, but if you know how much training it goes into it, and you know the skill level,
right,
it really kind of raises the bar. People doing anything super well is always interesting, and that's kind of where fighting is for me. If two guys that are really good at it are going at it, it's amazing.
Well, it's certainly like going and training for the first time certainly changed the way I thought about fighting in general. You don't have any clue. I mean, if you sit at home and you watch a UFC fight, you have no clue the type of cardio that it entails. You have no clue, you know, what it's like to go full force scale with somebody for a minute, let alone 3 minutes, let alone, you know, several rounds that are several minutes each. So what used to just be, hey, there's two guys rolling on the ground, you're like, holy shit. And to your point, you know, if you're gonna talk about sports, there is something different about fighting that's very, you know, you can't really fake your way through it. I mean, it's the results are right there. You know, if you're better than the other guy, you're gonna win, or you're gonna inflict damage, and vice versa. You know, if they're better than you, so that the consequences are immediate and
are a real
thing.
They
go right to your nervous system. Whereas if you lose,
you know, to bring it around to anything financial, which is, you know, the ostensible point here, but you can tell the people who really do it and the people who don't. And the people who really do it, even if they're bad relative to other practitioners, they're probably better than the people who are just lying. And kind of see it. You know, there's so many in the world of paper traders, you can tell immediately the people who have taken a loss before and gotten back up. You just can. You can just tell who they are. They're the ones that are not sitting around talking about their great boats and shit like that, because that's all just garbage. It's a process. Smart people are dumb all the time. And you need to figure out a way to get humble before you actually have real money on the line, or else it's going to get lost. Because the first thing you learn about being smart is, God, I don't know anything. And that's what you learn in fighting, too. You know, it's you learn two things. The first one is, oh, my God, it's terrifying. The second one is, even if you win, you're going to get punched in the face a couple times.
Right.
Which is a bummer. Yeah. And so, you know, anyone who says they like that is lying or insane. And, you know, it's so you conquer that fear. But it's all about getting in the ring, and it's all about actually being there. So, you know, I was having this debate last weekend about paper trading. It's like, you kind of have to have skin in the game, or it's really hard to simulate what you're going to do at the bottom, because everyone's risk averse until, you know, things are blowing up.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm trying to find a tweet that my buddy Open Outcrier, Ryan Sellers, put out yesterday or today. I can't remember, but it said something to that effect. Which was, you know, every day is a chance to fuck everything up when you're a trader. And, you know, your goal every day as a trader is not to let that happen, essentially. I'm trying to find the, is this it? I found it's amazing me how cheap traders, this is a picture of himself in front of his trading station. Here it is. He posted a photo of a trading firm on his floor of his office, and it says, this is what it looks like now when a trading firm blows up. And the photograph is of an office, you know, with a bunch of trading stations that have all been dismantled. And he writes, a screen and tower graveyard that will get picked over by the survivors in the next couple of days. Trading is hard. Gotta fight every day for the right to continue. And I just, that, you know, I was like, he nailed it. I mean, he nails it a lot, but that's, you know, you can tell that's, and I've talked to him. He's a friend of mine. I mean, I know the losses that he's taken, and I know the great days that he's had. And, you know, there's a grit to people that, you know, have been punched in the face before, either physically or while they're trading as well, Mackie. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I think you're dead on.
Yeah, you get a little of both. You know, I mean, it's you can't do anything for a super long time. I've been here for 20 years, like we said in the intro. I'm me. You know, they either know that or they don't. I'm not going to sit around and tell people I can do this for a living, because it's what I do for a living. The you know, it's, we've passed the sustainability point. But as you get older, you know, it's, I'm really big on self-awareness and just kind of taking inventory where you are. I can't imagine having a position on just, you know, that had everything riding on it. But I've been there before. I was there in the past. You know, as you get older, you start becoming more conservative with it. You have a nest egg to deal with, but kind of on the margins, you're still looking at that level of uncertainty, and you have to be able to kind of embrace the risk. Or a situation like we've been for the last few weeks, you know, the retailers ran like scalded dogs. That's the only sector I do. And so when they've been running for 10 months, obviously a pause is due. So, you know, I go to these conferences and people are asking what I like. A lot of my most effective trades are doing nothing. you know, when you're sitting on a position, it's basically I've kind of taken profits and a lot of stuff, and now I'm just sitting around waiting and gauging sentiments, in part at least, by how much I get heckled on Twitter for positions I don't even have. I woke up this morning, I shit you not, a panic dream that I was still holding Etsy in an account. I was convinced that I had like 3,000 shares of Etsy someplace and I didn't remember where. And so I'm pouring, it was as real as day. And I'm like, I'm going to get annihilated on it. And, you know, didn't have it. But I mean, it's old traders like golfers. We get the yips.
Right, right.
It's just like, oh, I can lift this thing out. If I don't put it steady, okay, just steady grip. Don't even think about missing it. Don't think about missing this. You know, it's you can never escape it. I will spend the rest of my life waking up at 1:30 in the morning wondering if I have Etsy on my book someplace and I'm about to get killed.
Wait, the yips is when you can't do something that you normally can do.
Yeah, well, yeah, trust me, a few more mornings of waking up trying to find the Etsy that I don't have because of the phantom pain that I'm about to feel on my account. It's that'll get me yipsy. That'll put me into the clubhouse. Yeah, no, you get some scar tissue. So some of the folks getting scar tissue in Pinterest as we talk right now, Wayfair today. You know, it's the consumer names get pretty dark this time of year. They miss a little bit, and people start kind of calculating out Christmas's future and
Wayfair's the stocks become sort of indefensible. Black hole. I mean, is it not?
It should be, but that's been true for a long time. You know, it's I don't know how the business model makes sense. Like a lot of them, you know, you have that core assumption that they get to critical mass before they die, which is a really big assumption. Yeah.
How long do they need to do that? 130 years? And $15 quadrillion in QE?
5 years ago, Amazon even nodding towards furniture would have been enough to kill that stock. So they kind of came in a sort of okay window where people are getting a little bit rational. It's becoming clear that Amazon's not going to own every sector. So, you know, Mesto figures to be a high end and they seem at least a little bit more dug in. They at least have kind of savvier, more experienced management than Wayfair, but it doesn't make a ton of sense. I mean, it kind of looks like a fancier Pier 1 without all the baggage, but it's looked that way since the jump.
And, at least Pier 1 made money at one point.
Yeah, they did. And then they, you know, it's, again, without the baggage. So what Pier 1 was making money on, they tried to cling to all the way down. I don't know what stage of the liquidation process they're in at this exact moment, but, you know, it's what's happening with some of the legacy retailers. You see it in Gap, you see it in Macy's. When they make money, they don't want to miss and they don't want to cut the dividend.
Right, right.
Because God forbid that we show any signs of weakness. As if people are walking into Macy's saying, this company's on top of the world, man. They're crushing. But, you know, so they ignore that common sense and management just figures, you know, if we don't cut the dividend, we'll be expressing confidence. Now, Macy's is yielding 10%. 10%.
Is it really?
They don't need, yeah. It's, which is essentially an inverted yield curve of a return. You know, I mean, right. It's they're paying you a preposterous amount. They're basically saying it's going to fall 10% before we even fill the order on this. So hopefully, you know, Godspeed getting to the dividend. But they have better things to do with the money. Northern got downgraded by Moody's yesterday. Moody's is a pile of crap. I don't care what Moody's thinks, but they have a point about Nordstrom having better things to do with the money than paying out a 4% yield to the family. So, you know, it's the companies that were making money actually, it was a joke for a long time, but they ended up being worse companies. Like they have a lot fewer options now because they tried to kind of bleed out quarter after quarter just to appease Wall Street. And if you look at these charts,
they just
department stores,
they just cling to it and they just go down with the ship. To it.
I mean, it. Look at the chart of Macy's. This company has been telling me for literally 10 years that they have double-digit sales growth in their digital segment. Look at the chart. Why are you telling me this? It's not working. You know, that's not just me being a dick. It's the stock down 80%. That's what's telling me that Wall Street doesn't care about your double-digit growth. So stop that.
Is there a price where you buy Macy's, Mackie?
Yeah, whatever price it's trading at when they get rid of the management team and the new team comes in and says we're pulling all the estimates. It's that's their only shot.
Right. Just kitchen sink it.
Just kitchen sink it. And I'm not short of, because we're getting to the point on a few of these where kitchen sinking, you know, that gives them easily the best opportunity. And it's worth at least 5 or 10% to the stock. Because what they're doing now is I know it sounds dramatic and I know it sounds, you know, like it's I'm shroomy or something, but listen, they're it's just diminishing returns. You know, they're managing these retail stores like they're water utilities, and the problem is stores age and they fall apart and they become decrepit and obsolete and they go away. You know, New Yorkers are shocked that Barney's is gone. They're a little out of touch on that because there's only 22 of them, and like their target client is P. Diddy and LeBron. You know, so I think they might be missing a little bit of the retail universe with that Barney's. But you know, that's just companies like that that just stay in these tiny like little lanes.
1920s, they get blown up like oil magnates. I can see shopping at Barney's. Yeah. You know.
Oh,
Jeeves, take me down to Barney's. I've got to get a new outfit, you know.
We're a hedge against prohibition, see? Because the fellas come in and they bought those zoot suits. What the hell is the business plan? It's owned by 9 different guys. But they're just becoming a brand house now. And so they're going to have Barney's be part of Saks, which is kind of more than Barney's deserves.
Well, that's 2 stores that I'll be avoiding in one, which will save me the trip of, you know, not walking into both of them. Now it'll be 1 store that I can avoid.
You don't need a place with attitude. I'm a big believer in everybody's got their experience. And so, you know, there is a customer base that likes to be fussed over a little bit. But the problem that these stores have is that you really can't provide that level of service. What Nordstrom has, and this is not a stock call, because holy crap, I'm sick of people emailing me with stocks I don't even own are down. But the advantage that they have as they build out their base, as they build the Manhattan store, and as they structure themselves, is that they actually will be able to provide service, you know, because it still have the digital back end to do it. If you're at Saks, just someone coming up to you and being really polite while they tell you they're out of stock, that's not actually service. That's just someone being polite and useless. So
when I think about Saks, I think about the you know, the old woman walking outside of Lincoln Center with the big giant hat on and way too much makeup, you know, who's lived, you know, it was probably like performed off Broadway in the 40s and has been in Manhattan her whole life, and you know, with the lipstick that misses the lips, and you know, the caked on makeup, you know, there's your Barney's shopper, you know, like everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about.
And the third husband died like 20 years ago, and who knows what the hell he did, but he had a ton of cash, and she just spouts money everywhere she goes.
With the little Pomeranian.
Oh, buddy, man, it's my dad was, he worked for the Dayton's family. You know, they had cash. We didn't have cash. He was the help, you know, but you get to see it. It's Dayton department stores. They carried fancy silk gloves up until the mid-90s. You know, for specifically one of the Mrs. Daytons who was into fancy silk gloves. Like they tailored it that much to this particular woman. There's a reason it's now a division of Macy's, and the Target Corporation's moved on to better opportunities, because tailoring to the little old woman is not necessarily the future of retail.
It's not like put on your gloves. It's cold outside. It's like, these are just my everyday gloves. I just wear these when I leave the house. You know?
Yeah.
Winter, spring, summer, fall. And their
target marketing to Mrs. Havisham. Just ladies rattling around in their decrepit mansions. Come here, crazy lady. Let's put the cats away and come down to the store. These are not high margin customers, so you can't give service. And so we've talked about it before. The winners and losers, like Macy's, if they tried super hard to be polite, they just don't have the tools to do it. And so when would I buy them? You know, it's hope, spit, and lying to me about your double-digit sales in digital are not going to keep the stock higher. It doesn't make it a great short, but if it goes to 20 again, I'll short it again, because it's not going anywhere. It's just you know, these stocks all trade on opinions. And anytime anyone wants to talk about retail, anytime people start booking me at conferences over the last couple of years, it's time to sell the stocks for a few months because, you know, it's they're just super quick to give up on them. You know, it's Nike was a great trade going into earnings. It's a great trade every time they're going into earnings because they're the most competitive bastards on earth. They never miss. But they spend the rest of the quarter just casually pissing everyone off for no reason at all. We've started a feud with China. That's what life is like as a Nike shareholder. No one's going to protest that, but you know they'll kill the stock for it. And once the algos start taking the stocks down, then it just becomes technicals. I mean, right now I'm just looking at Target, kind of waiting for it to tick into the 90s just because it's sitting out there. That'll be a pullback. People will be afraid. I have absolutely no fundamental concerns about the story, but you know, it's just too popular, and ultimately, kind of these companies don't lever enough on the bottom line to get those super fantasy valuations, which kind of is a self check on a lot of these consumer stocks. You know, the Gooses of the world, they collapse pretty fast because there's just not any scale there, and the margins at the bottom line. You know, you can't come up with a $50 billion valuation for Goose because ultimately you have a 5% margin on a down coat.
Yeah, I mean, is Target still basically your favorite? Like, if you had to pick one name in the space that's you want to hold for, you know, a long time, would that be Target? I mean, the last time we talked, we kind of went over this.
Yeah, you know, and that's going to be one that I want to buy on dips. Walmart's going to be there. You're going to get the big four that have boxes right now: Home Depot, right. Costco, Target, Walmart. Target, I flatter them by making them part of it, but they have the best model in sort of the big box stores right now, and that makes them win. Now you can argue where the stock's going to be. I'm a fanboy of it, or accused of it anyway. I can make a valuation argument between 90 and 110 pretty much just as easily. Like, I can just, you know, slap that NBA bullshit all over the top of it and sell it hardcore just as easily. Just a couple multiples here, move this digit there. But I want that ballpark. What I know for sure is that their margins are expanding really slowly. They're still getting positive traffic, meaning more people are coming to the stores, and they're still getting average check prices going higher. So if more people are coming to the store and they're spending more while they're there, that eventually is going to lead to a higher stock price. That's just how it works.
One of my listeners wants to know what you think of RVLV. They say it's the same demographic as Lulu with a very strong supply chain and excellent customer service. I don't even know what company that is. I'm assuming it's a retail company. Revolve Group?
There are. I've got them already siloed basically as, you know, a competitor to Lulu. Lulu is the competitor to Lulu. There are
what brand do they have that I would know?
Who, RVLV? No idea. Riverdale? It's the Archie Andrews operation over there with Veronica Lodge. There are a ton of them. I'm not going to blame guess the tickers. If you want me to do that, we can do that. But it's a sell because anything like Lulu, you're better off sticking with Lulu. I deal with a lot of these private companies who are on this side, and I dabble with some tiny cap retailers that I'm not even going to mention the names because I'm not in the business to get people to chase my inventory so I can sell it to them.
Right.
But for the most part, you know, it's the winners are going to be the winners. We're going to find out in February that all the stores that looked like they were doing well kicked ass. And
I love Lululemon's men's clothes.
Right. And you know, so it's price for perfection. Someone downgraded it. But when you walk through the mall, the spread is huge just in terms of the energy level and quality of the product they have and kind of the incremental traffic. Right. Now, guys like you picking it up on the margins going, these pants are more comfortable. Now, it's not a huge secret, and this is the easiest time in history to kind of start knockoff apparel companies. And so you're seeing a lot of these companies come up with you know, alternatives to wool pants, thank God. Which is fantastic. But they don't get the 55, 56% margins that Lulu does. Lulu has really built through kind of good timing on executive rotations, and they beat an infrastructure into place that they were there at the right time to become sort of the first omni-channel. And so they got a third of their business online, a third in the stores, and they expanded into men's from yoga pants. They actually became, they're going to be a $1 billion men's brand, if not next year, soon. And you know, that's a real thing. So all of a sudden you've got like a $6 or $7 billion company with men's firing past $1 billion and really not even tapped as a market yet. And they're able to get the margins that they want, while the Gap and everybody else, basically if you see a 20% off sign in front of any store, just don't buy the stock, because no one's competing on price, and the people who are getting any share, they're charging whatever they want. And that's just kind of how it's going. Gap could not give it away right now. Victoria's Secret, nobody wants their stuff because it's just hot garbage. It's all brands, it's all availability, and it's all, you know, can you get it to me now in the size that I want? And if you can, you can sell it. But if not, you know, people don't care about your 25% off. Just go away.
Yeah, you know, speaking of which, we were at that mall at Caesar's Palace when so for those that don't know, Jeff and I both appeared at the same conference last month at Caesar's, and we were walking through those
forum. You don't shops. Have to explain us shopping at Caesar's Palace. If we want to stop at Caesar's Palace, we can do that.
Oh yeah. I was searching for 20% off signs, trust me. I was did my luxury shopping at H&M, you know. But yeah, I mean, that was a pretty nice mall, and that seemed, I mean, I know we were in the middle of downtown Las Vegas, and but that was a really nice mall, and there was a nice vibe in that mall, and it looked as though retail was alive and well, again, in the middle of a tourist trap, in the middle of a city that's a giant hustle, but I liked walking around that mall.
People shop, dude. It's, you know, we've gone kind of to the other end of it. I have no idea where people are in the retail apocalypse story now, but it's a good mall. Will always be kind of an interesting place to go because a lot of people are there. Your kids are relatively safe in kind of the community property that you get, and everyone's looking out for each other. And it's just an activity. And so we're past sort of the idea that they're going to be empty. We're still in the point that you and I also talked about, where Amazon needs a lot of real estate, and they need it really bad, and they need it really fast. So I'm not super worried about the empty malls. I don't really know if Amazon, in fact, I'm sure they don't have the solution yet, but I don't know how understood that is. When Amazon says, you know, our grocery program, Amazon Fresh, is now part of Prime, that's not bad for the other retailers. That's Amazon operating from weakness. They've got a problem. They don't have stores, and it's much harder to distribute. They're spending $1.5 billion in this quarter just trying to get to one-day shipment, which that's a super tiny market. So someone who wants one day, like they want it really bad but not enough to go to Target today, they're willing to wait one day, not two. I mean, they're spending $3-4 billion this year getting from 2 days to 1 day. What the hell is the point of that? You know, they need stores. So it doesn't make Amazon the short of the century, but it makes me more comfortable that as you know, the entire thesis has been that once the digital players start having to build stores, then they're kind of playing to the strengths of the other people in the space. Home Depot is a really good store. Walmart has a ton of terrific locations. Costco has a nice niche. You know, before those little old ladies smear lipstick on their teeth and go to Barney's, they're going to Costco once every week for much of their lives because they have families. You know,
right.
It's there's a life cycle to all this stuff. And companies that you know, are selling things that sort of make it easier to conduct the stuff that everyone needs in their houses during their lives, and they capture share. And Target just kind of sticking into that niche of we're going to be the easiest place to shop, that's a super good position to have right now.
I'm going to give you two names in retail, both of which I'm guessing you don't like. And I'm going to tell you that you got to buy one of them, you got to sell the other one. And I want you to tell me what your reasoning is. So you got to force yourself to buy one and force yourself to sell the other.
I'm probably going to reject the premise just to spoil it. But
you,
yeah,
can't, you can't reject the premise. This is my podcast. So it's my fucking rules. If you want to reject the premise, you know, you can go on.
I'll tell you why if I do. Okay, go ahead. Fire.
All right. Overstock and Bed Bath & Beyond.
Bed Bath & Beyond for sure.
You would buy or you would sell?
I would buy.
You would buy
the I own. I've owned in various sizes, and depending on your area.
Well, I thought you were critical of Bed Bath & Beyond.
I totally was. And you told me that in public. You accused me of it. They became a whole, totally different company the second they got rid of their team and they brought in a Target guy.
Right.
At that point, it's a buy. At that point, it's. I know the Target guy can retail because everyone at Target can retail or else they don't. They get fired. And so, it makes sense from where Target and Walmart have been coming in terms of the digital operations that a lot of the guys that were superstars and building out these not quite done, but certainly ready to scale digital sides for the bigger chains would be looking for startup jobs. They'd be going to become CEO now. Because if you're 45 and, you put together Target's digital, you want a shot at the title, your own opportunity, and you don't need 50 guys in an organization all trying to kill the CEO. So it makes sense to have those, it's a good move for someone who presumably has done well at a really good organization. And so that makes it a startup. That means that all of a sudden they go immediately, Bed Bath goes from a company that's going to miss the earnings, the old management team, is still, having conversations about the transition away from coupons as though that's not a decision that maybe they could have made at some point over the last two decades. We're still looking into this. If you're a new CEO, you don't have any of that.
Right.
He gets to walk in and he gets to call bullshit on all of it.
Yep.
And if you do it right, and anyone worth their salt, or at least, a CEO worthy person, they're going to be able to have enough of a plan to tell a story that they'll get the benefit of the doubt for two or three quarters, And so at the very least, I never short new CEOs. If they have a base of stores, if they have a fleet of stores, all of a sudden Bed Bath looks like a really good acquisition opportunity to me.
Sure.
All of a sudden, that looks a lot like what kind of footprint Amazon will want, what kind of footprint anybody who wants to start distributing goods on a mass basis and has the money to buy them out would be looking for, which are kind of nice boxes in decent but not great locations that are close to large urban or large living centers, large residential areas. That's Bed Bath all over the place. So, you get a smart manager in there. Estimates don't matter. So if they miss, it doesn't matter. They're not in immediate danger of going bankrupt. They might, but that's not really my problem in the next year or so. And so for a trade, I'm willing to bet that he's going to have at least something compelling to say. And you can get that stock. We talked about it online. It went from 10 to 15 just hiring a smart guy.
Right.
Now you figure, it settles in. Wait for him to actually say something. it's when they report, he won't have much to say yet, so he gets a pass on that. But if there's any type of plan that makes more sense than the absolute void that they had before, this stock can be 17-18 before they have to prove much of anything.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with you there. And it's interesting to hear. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, I think that's where we are in this retail recovery.
Would you feel similarly situated about Macy's if they scrapped management and they brought they brought somebody in from Target, or they brought somebody in who has a real success track record in retail?
Not necessarily, because I think they've gone too far down the path of of they're a big real estate concern at this point. Yeah, they're leaning so hard on, we've got all these stores that are worth so much if we chop them up and sell them. That remains a maybe. And so I'm not positive if just doing retail can be enough for them. And once it becomes a real estate thing, I lose interest. I'm just not as good at that as I am at the other. So
what did you what did you speak about in Vegas? What was your presentation on at the Nigerian conference?
in Vegas, I was just trying to get people's minds around it. You know, October was a huge month for a lot of these stocks. And so, you know, it went from, as I was preparing this speech, look at these unloved things, to some of the stocks started rallying. And then it really became a sticking to the brand, sticking to distribution, and just trying to step away from the noise, which ahead of the noise makes for, you know, a speech with a lot of snark in it to keep it lively. But now we're kind of seeing a lot of these stocks come back.
Right.
And so, you know, it's McDonald's was a company I talked about then. You know, that stock did what it was supposed to do, which is go retest that 200. It's going to mess with that as resistance and support for a while. But in the meantime, it's consolidating a double essentially over the last 5 years since Easterbrook has been there. And they're going to have a network of 20,000 McDonald's all through the country. Eventually, they're going to be able to scale that into a real advantage because, you know, that's what Amazon's telling us. That's what every merchant is telling us, is that there's an advantage to having physical locations. And McDonald's, for all their problems, they have way more physical location. They have way more physical presence than anyone else by far. And so that's a stock that they've gone, you know, they've sold the units that the corporation owned, and it's largely just franchisees now. That takes some adjusting. The stock is going to take some growth adjustments, but man, the leverage that they have is just way beyond what you're going to see in you know, the Shake Shacks of the world. I mean, those two are, they might as well not even be in the same industry. People hold them up together all the time. They're just not the same company.
What's the main differentiating factor there?
20,000 McDonald's
worldwide in the Vatican.
I mean, it's, they, you know, McDonald's could deliver with trebuchets. They could fire McDonald Happy Meals into your car as you drove down the freeway with the right app. Just kind of think it, you know, that's maybe a 5G Wi-Fi thing. But in the meantime, they just have a more efficient operation. And so they got to play to their strengths, which is, you know, we're not complete garbage food or just random quality like a QSR operation, like a Burger King. But, you know, we're going to give you precisely McDonald's level food, and we're going to make sure that that's a little higher, to rationing that up a little bit. But we're going to give it to you fast, and we're going to give it to you close. You know, where Shake Shack, a lot of times you got to get out of the car, you got to go into the mall. It's kind of that gray area between dining.
Yeah, and Americans don't want to walk, you know?
What's that?
I said Americans don't want to walk. We don't have to get out of the
we
car.
We will, but, you know, it's...
Roll our fat asses into the Shake
last
Shack.
Week. Hey, man, look at Chipotle. That is the life cycle of quality food. You know, they have those Fiona Apple commercials. People Google that right now. Well, wait while you go Google Imagination by Fiona Apple. Drop a tab of acid and enjoy what Chipotle used to call advertising. That was like 5 years ago. Then they started poisoning people. The stock got full in half. They brought in a guy from Taco Bell, and now they're just the same restaurant chain as everybody else, basically. And, you know, they've stabilized and the stock has redoubled because they became a grown-up restaurant. But that's really sort of, that'll be the Shake Shack cycle. They'll grow too big, it'll be hard to make quality a priority anymore. And at that point, we'll get to see if it really scales. Because right now, they're getting lines out the door just with their name and with burgers that, if we're super honest, taste an awful lot like about five different chains, at least out here.
Yeah, and certainly the way that McDonald's and other, you know, like Chick-fil-A, they're all going to the app now. They're all going to delivery now. They're all going to license plate readers now on the cars at the drive-thru. That's kind of the next iteration. You know, you pull up, they already know, like, what your three favorite things to order are. They, you know, just trying to get you in and get you out quicker without having to go into the restaurant.
And that's really that's a lot. You know, it's not everything to everybody, but if you're McDonald's, that's sort of what you signed up for when you went there. And so if they when they started grilling the quarter pounder with cheeses, that was a huge deal. You know, and people laugh about me actually going in and walking out. I made a nice living off McDonald's having slightly better hamburgers than people thought last year or 2 years ago. And that is just quality. You know, they brought up the level of what they're serving. They're not serving those tiny little hamburgers with the little meat discs and the diced onion. You know, it's that's not kind of their main gig anymore. And, you know, by raising the level just a little bit, by keeping it kind of in that respectable belt where mom doesn't have to feel embarrassed or dad doesn't have to feel embarrassed about offering McDonald's, they can, you know, expand the market and not just be the last resort. Any brand, you know, that is the last resort that people are embarrassed to go to, they've got big problems. I mean, that was Walmart a few years ago. If you look at the stock, where it was mired in just like, you know, the dumps, and that they slowly turned that around by treating their employees better, frankly, and it started leaking down to the way customers were treated. And you can see the customer levels, basically the responses from the customers towards Walmart improved slowly and gradually, and it's still a situation where no one wants to admit that they shop at or have ever been to a Walmart, but they're managing to sell $1 billion a day to Americans every single day. And I see people there when I go there. I don't have any shame about it. If they respect their customers, will come back.
They have to ship you your Walmart groceries like they used to ship the Girls Gone Wild DVDs, you know, in nondescript brown paper bag coverings, you know, with a big stamp on the outside that says not porn on it, you know?
Not porn, yeah. Even from Walmart.
There was a band that we toured with like a long time ago, like 15 years, 20 years ago, called I Voted for Kodos, and their album, their first album was called Not Penis Cream, and the photo on the front of the album was a big package, you know, a brown paper bag wrapped package with a giant stamp on it that just said Not Penis Cream, you know. I don't know why
movie
still
titles
that
will
funny,
not appear
but
on the hotel bill.
Oh, Jeff, I love a nice dick joke. I gotta tell you, buddy, 37 years old I'll be in December, and I'll just that. And you know what? I'll think of that again tonight once I'm in bed, and it'll be fucking brand new again. And I'll laugh about it for like another 15 minutes by myself.
It'll still be funny. You're only human.
So I was talking to Chris, who is John and Pete Najarian's left hand man, right hand man, whatever. The guy that gets all the shit.
Whichever one is useful.
Right, exactly. See, and I didn't even feel the need to make a masturbation joke there, which I guess if I pointed it out, I still kind of did. The point of the matter is, I was talking to Chris, not about masturbation, but about the panel that we did afterwards, after you gave your presentation, you had the pleasure of moderating a quote-unquote panel with Peter Schiff and I, in which you spent roughly 40 minutes trying to stop Peter Schiff from talking because...
No, I wasn't really trying that hard. That's kind of part of the gimmick. There's a little bit of Mean Gene Okerlund with him where you're like, hey, strong words from an angry man, Peter Schiff, what do you think?
Oh,
you're
man.
Not gonna stop him. He's got his gig and he's gonna do it.
He just went and went and went. And I had to borrow Mike Gravel's line from the 2008 presidential election when he was like, he was doing one of the debates and he's like, I'm starting to feel like a potted plant up here on stage. And yeah, that was an interesting experience. I hope the video for that comes out so people just see you trying to like interject it, like every in between every sentence, you've kind of got your mouth opening, your finger like. You know, making these like weird throat noises. Like, hey, I'm gonna try to say something here, and it was just like, fucking forget it. You know?
Yeah, truthfully, that's kind of just in deference to the crowd. I've done TV with him before, and it might be a New York or a finance thing, but you'll occasionally get segments where it would just be the host and the reporter trying to talk over each other. Usually
right.
Be Gasparino involved. And, you know, it would just be like, if you just let me finish. And so you'd get two grown men just yelling at one another. If you let me finish, you know, they're both literally saying the same thing over each other. So I've interviewed Peter before. He's got his gimmick and, you know, it's the greatest hits band and people who want to hear that stuff, you know, they're going to hear it. I don't know. I investment theses kind of change. And so, you know, I've interviewed people I've invested for a long time. I'm not saying the same stuff. Most people who kind of do this, you stick to the same fundamental skills, but you're really talking about different companies and different ideas over time. If if your living relies on creating alpha, because you can't just kind of wait for it all the time. I mean, someone in the audience mentioned stocks that I picked 10 years ago and he dismissed them as day trading stocks. Yeah. If that's what you're up against, I've been flipping them for a decade. Just, 12% of my life I've been locked in these wild day trading things. It's just kind of bonkers. So, but the truth is, there's more to say when you're bearish. Bearish case always sounds smarter, and usually it's bullshit. So you kind of just let it run.
Well, what I said on the panel, though, is what I'll say now, which is I think it's important to have guys like Peter out there. And I agree with a lot of what Peter says. I mean, it depends on your ideology of how you look at the markets, right? I think that a lot of it is philosophical, a lot of it is ideological. And this is what I said kind of maybe a little bit to his chagrin on the panel. I just think it's important to keep that perspective in mind. And I think it's important to kind of at least hear from that side, because you don't hear from that angle on mainstream media. You don't hear from that angle, in a JP Morgan sell side report. You don't hear from it anywhere. And so, I think it's really important that he's out there and he is, you call it a gimmick and you say stick into a narrative. But really, if you ideologically, if your take on economics comes from, a classical or Austrian perspective, I mean, that's how you look at things. The reality of the situation is, Jim Chano said to me once, this is an unprecedented experiment in monetary policy. And I always say that. And, the results will probably be unprecedented as well. And something will probably give at some point. But the timing is up in the air. And whether or not it happens is still to some degree up in the air. And but I think it's important to have both sides heard from. And I mean,
I have no problem with that. My thing is I talk about narratives changing. Think of the banks. Now, I was there when the banks blew up. I was on TV every single day talking about the banks blowing up. I was threatening to break into people's homes if they didn't sell their bank stocks, so they would sell their effing bank stocks because they just clung to them. I, to this day, don't own a bank stock because it was pretty well revealed that there's a lot of key assumptions there throughout the balance sheet that make the balance sheet more or less just crap.
Right.
And, the stress test just as an idea is absurd. It's an open book test that an entire institution gets to take. My God, it sounds like a gut class for meatheads at college. And of course, they pass the stress test. I believe, everyone in the stress test class gets A's, I think, pretty much every quarter. It's crap, so I don't want to see it. But that doesn't mean the entire system has to necessarily fall apart. It underestimates the resiliency of the overall system. So it is useful to keep all that stuff out there, but it is true that a lot of it is in the Wizard of Oz, which was written 130 years ago.
Well, I mean, so, what's your take?
You got to reconcile the two.
What's your take when you see the Fed come out and, cut interest rates yesterday?
I think the Fed is largely figureheads. I think I have absolutely no edge. I think I sit in gobsmacked awe at the miracle of our checks and balances system, that it can be this much of a clusterfuck and we're not absolutely at all time lows. So, I think we have a really well designed system, broadly speaking. And so if you have this adversary relationship with the president, who's taking unprecedented approaches towards kind of communications and just openly heckling the Fed chair, it's good to have that guy sit there and have to answer questions. But in terms of the actual practice, what the Fed has established to me over the last decade is they're going to do whatever the hell it takes. And if that means that he has to stand there and say, we're printing literal unicorns, we're taking horses and jamming horns right into their skulls and grafting them on there, people will believe it. They'll do whatever it takes. And so it's kind of just a lot of jawboning. They're printing their own money.
At what point does it get so egregious that you start to reconsider?
When I start seeing it in the way people behave. It's economics is a social science. That can never ever be stated quite enough. We're applying math to social behaviors. That's another thing that the financial crisis taught us. When you have to sell, no one's buying. Yeah, it's an economic truth that is hardwired in our limbic system. The best way to sell something to anyone is to refuse to. You know, it's the hawk spin approach. You can't have this. Well, I want it. You know, so you know, it's at what point does it break? It'll break with some other exogenous panic. In 07 and 08, people start getting their homes repossessed. That broke it pretty fast because people like where they live. You know, and but it reassembled itself because Americans, you know, when you have some level of prosperity in a much more fluid economic situation than we had in the Great Depression, where you're not going to have people starving on one coast, a bunch of food in the middle, and people starving on the other coast. You have a better distribution now. It's a more robust system. And so it's much huger and much more apt to tip over. But we have more sophisticated instruments, and we have an entire globe that we can trade with. So, you know, when does it tip over? I don't know. I'm not seeing the extreme signs of distress. It's not, you know, the machine isn't hiccuping and smoking the way it has before past meltdowns, meaning you're not seeing like 50% declines in formerly respectable stocks. You can see a Deutsche Bank slowly blowing up day after day after day without dragging everyone down. So I think, you know, what would change my mind is a blow up someplace where we don't expect it. Because in the financials, we sort of expected it and saw it and it happened. And, you know, the sky is still aloft.
Yeah, but you can see that the road that monetary policy is on isn't ideal.
Oh, hell yes. If I had an ideal policy, I would go do that for a living. No, I'm really just trying to stay as agnostic as possible about it.
Sure.
And looking at 70% of the economy, which nobody wants to cover my little sector, and saying that, listen, if these people are buying, then you can kind of say they feel optimistic about getting a job or they feel good about the one they have. But I'm seeing growth in companies that are good at selling things. And I'm seeing, you know, shrinkage in companies that are bad. To me, that's the universe that's working the way it should. And so, you know, and I know it's my own little niche. I know we can argue about that it's all credit and hot money and fueled by this and that, but it's 70% of the economy and it's month after month after month. And so there's sort of a critical mass to the behavior of the people that you really have to look at how the people are actually behaving before we start kind of modeling out the recessions and the panics to come, which we ran into this problem last year, Chris, where you know, last year, October was a shit show. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you know, now that October is closed, as you and I are talking, I'm willing to go out on a limb and suggest it was better than last year. Last year, stocks just went down every damn day. And you know, the retailers were smacked the hardest, if anything, and because we were just, there was a recession coming and everyone had to know about it. And it didn't matter what the companies would say. It didn't matter what the channel checks would look like. It was just going to happen. And it never happened, you know? And so now it's been a year later. My problem isn't that the monetary policies are wrong. My problem is that the timing on it matters a lot because that was a year ago.
Right.
You know, and you get, if you're lucky, 30 years kind of having the job that you want to do, and maybe 15 of those you're actually good at it. You're shitty at it for 5 years to start and 10 years at the end. You know, it's so you got a pretty small window. So, you know, a year's a long time. It's calling Peter right or wrong when we talk about it. Just he and I have been having the same conversation for 15 years. That's, you know, a big percentage of the run that you get.
Well, and one of the things that, you know, I said on that panel, I mean, I only said like one or two things, but yeah, one of the things that I said on the panel and definitely said to you privately when we had a cocktail afterwards was timing does matter. And, you know, where I'll differ from somebody like Peter is I won't, you know, it's difficult for me to come out and say, hey, it's going to be next week. It's going to be this month. It's going to be this quarter. It's going to be this year. It's going to be this decade. You know, I think there is a happy medium between realizing really, you know, the true way that economics should function and basic economic laws and applying that to how many kind of sigma deviations we are away from the norm at this point, which is, you know, a million or whatever, and then realizing that timing is, for the most part, pretty much unpredictable. Nobody was going to, you know, nobody predicted for the most part that 2007, 2008 was going to happen, except Peter Schiff. But, you know, he had also been calling for recessions in the years prior to that and the years subsequent to that. The timing is really difficult. I think that if people can just get to a place where they understand, you know, where the bearish case on a macro level is rooted, and if they can wrap their head around the whole system and the way that everything works, they can have a more balanced kind of approach to things. But I can't come out and say I know when it's going to happen. I think that's foolish, because again, it's unprecedented. So I agree with him and I agree with you.
But it my point is, it's always unprecedented. That you know, if it weren't, life would be much more boring than it is, and
right,
you know, much more predictable. And so it never shows up. You know, a lot of people were talking about the meltdown. I don't say that bragging. I say that because I sat at endless conversations with traders talking about it. It was really hard to trade it. The people that made money are this combination of right place, right time, and guys like Burry, who were in a lot of really hairy, complicated derivatives that not a lot of people had access to.
Right.
So, you know, once Bear went, just, you know, it wasn't a huge secret that things were getting pretty bad, because everybody knew someone at Bear, and they ceased to exist. That was, you know, so the idea that like a year later we were all shocked when it melted down, it's like, well, hell, I knew 20 guys that got laid off a year ago. So, you know, like, and not just laid off, like the company disappeared. So it was hard to take it personally as a performance
different
review.
Kind of laid
literally,
off.
You're a different kind of laid off. When everybody loses their job, you know it's not really you.
Right.
And
right.
So this was something you could see coming, but there is a certain beyond meat element to it, where it's like, it's a hard borrow. The options are super expensive. So why don't we just go hide in the corner here and kind of ride it out?
Right.
You know, it's, yeah, you know, the move to gold at the time, that was the big thing. I was there in after 9/11, and that was the same thing too. And, you know, society to this day does not remain equipped to pay for things in gold. And so if, you know, they got hairy around here and someone came into my house with what they said was a chunk of gold, I would have no way to verify that. That's not a real unit of exchange to me. I would rather take a dollar and hope the power comes back on.
Well, yeah, but you could also argue again that gold holdings are a hedge against the, you know, the reduction of the purchasing power of the dollar. So, I mean, even if you're not going to get a premium to it, you know, gold that you hold ostensibly priced in dollars should rise as the dollar depreciates, right?
I know, but I can make more money if I'm able to guess how many pants Lululemon's going to sell next quarter. And the truth is, if I can do that with some level of success for like 15 or 20 years, then after that, you know, well, I can just put some money in gold and kind of spread my bets.
Right, right.
Go to the mall.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a straw man argument, but the buy and hold forever, or to a degree, you know, the value investing or the momentum investing and all that stuff, it's just labels, and implicit in any label and kind of my skepticism of it, it's not a personal thing. It's just that there's a racket built into all of them.
Right.
You know, it's they're marketing businesses, and, you know, asset gathering and running assets are two different jobs.
So
it's that simple. And so, you know, some people are good at both. A lot of people are good at both. But, you know, for the most part, people who are kind of specializing in just running money are doing just that. And, you know, I don't have a complicated story. I can see freely, A, that it's broken, B, that, you know, in terms of the monetary system, it's a much more compelling argument. I can sound a lot smarter if I start kind of making the more negative case. But the truth is, in my experience in this time, having ridden through the dot-com mess and the financial meltdown and all of it, you know, we're still here. Like, the optimists are the ones who end up loaded. Yeah, they're the ones who end up with the money and the toys and kind of being right. And the other guys sound much smarter the whole time. So you need to be able to kind of know it's all crap, know where it can fall apart to your point, but also, you know, be able to hold optimistic thoughts at the same time, because it usually kind of works out.
Well, historically, it certainly has. But again, historical performance is not an indicator of future performance, right? So
the sun's going to blow up someday, but it's a shitty trade.
when you look at the election coming up in 2020, what do you think?
You know, I thought Trump could win last time, actually. I have a Tumblr page to prove it. I don't know. I don't think I there's no one that resonates with me, and I doubt I'm alone in feeling that way. So I have no idea. You know, Elizabeth Warren doesn't seem like she likes me, and she doesn't seem, you know, it's I can't believe Joe Biden's there. I don't understand. Like, you know, it's if he's so terrible, why the Democrats can't come up with someone more compelling? And so I kind of just try to stay as apolitical as possible, because again, it's another thing where it's just really hard for me to make money off it. If you got bearish off Trump, you got murdered. And this country lives and dies off the stock market. If you want the rich people to leave you alone, just drive the Dow higher. He knows it. So, you know, that's kind of the situation we're in. We make a bunch of noises about how we're going to go after the rich and we're going to tax them and we're going to do this and that. The whole idea of America is that everybody wants to be rich and we all feel like we have a shot at it. And so, you know, they never penalize the rich because everybody wants to have the same freaking tax scheme that Fred Trump seemed to have.
Is the economy really kind of the number one issue for you when you consider candidates?
Oh, yeah, entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, just because I've met a lot of these guys and they're largely the same, but it's in terms of, you know, it's a horror show. I'm not really super excited and don't feel like my views are represented on either side, but I'd rather not have my wrestling events in Saudi Arabia. You know, but yeah, for the most part, it has to be economic, and I'm not sure how much the guy in charge has control over that. You know, it's I've seen divisive and I've seen scary, and it's easy to talk about how the world's never been scarier, but man, yeah. At 51, I can remember when the commies shot down a jet over Korea, and it felt like a decent chance that we were just going to make a charcoal briquette out of the entire planet to keep the Soviets from taking us over. That was scary. That seemed really hairy. That seemed really bad. It's better now. You know, I'm not sure kind of it's how people can reconcile their feelings of discontent and frustration with the president with the fact that, you know, it was worse when the world was on the cusp of exploding almost all the time.
If you walk into the booth today, you have to pull the lever on one of the declared Democratic candidates or Trump. Who do you pull the lever on?
You know what? I pulled the lever twice. I'm not going to lie. In 2000, the last time around. And I tell you what happened. I voted against daylight savings time. And yet, we are just days away from my clock falling back.
Yeah.
My position won. And California voted against daylight savings, voted against changing our clocks ever again, and we're going to do it this weekend. So I'm kind of wondering if democracy isn't a scam. Might be a little bit of a ripoff. I'm not sure. Which is a long way of saying I don't see anyone I'm going to vote for yet, but I'm sure they'll emerge.
Yeah, well, when they do, come back on and talk to me about it.
I will.
I know people are like,
fired up or not to vote
voting
for
is it's a personal decision, you know? It's like, well, fuck that. I want to ask about it anyways. You know, it makes for good conversation.
I fucking hate daylight savings time, dude. I'm more than happy to talk to you about that, particularly in the spring when we spring forward for no apparent reason. Wow. But all politics are local and fetishized to your personal issue, especially in California. You know, I'm standing out looking at acres and miles of perfection in California. It's so perfect here, they can't possibly screw it up no matter how hard they try, and they'd never stop trying. Right. America's kind of the same way, you know? I mean, it's like, as long as we keep it just the right level of super screwed up, it's not going to go completely off the tracks. And that's kind of where my position is. You know, it's how's that reconcile into a trade? Well, I think this is going to be the biggest Christmas ever. Just, you know, and it will. Because that's, you know, when stocks are high, Americans spend more money than they did the year before.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's how I'm positioned. That's how I'm playing it. And that's how it's actually played out for, you know, pretty much all the last years. Like, we had one down Christmas, and that was 2009. So Americans like to spend money if they like Christmas.
And we'll talk about how we're going to pay it all back next year. We'll fucking worry about it.
Sounds like a problem, you know, for next year.
Exactly. We'll just whistle zippity-doo-dah out of our assholes.
Hey, right, Chris, I want you to look into a child's eye and you tell him that you didn't believe in next year enough to buy him a Christmas present.
I just okay? put a,
and you just tell me then how you feel, Mr. Negative.
I just put a draft of a tweet up that I was going to send out, but I was late to call you, so I called you, which is the Fred chart of the purchasing power of the dollar since the 1920s going straight down. And I wrote, I'm going to just print these out on sheets of paper and hand them to children at Halloween. You know, and decades from now, when they come to and they realize what it is, you know, that'll be far more valuable than a Snickers bar. Actually, you know what? My family always handed out full-size candy bars. That's a tradition that I continue. At Halloween, we were like, not too many people in our neighborhood did that, but my mom always went to Costco, which used to be called the Price Club, as I'm sure you know, and would buy the fucking industrial size, you know, Crunch bars and Hershey bars, so that when kids came to the door, we had the full size candy bar. That was my parents.
You come from good people. Oh. You come from good people.
And you know what?
Absolutely.
We weren't swimming in it. Dad was a mailman. Mom worked at the library. But still, you know, they didn't skimp on Halloween, my parents. Set a good example.
Exactly.
Quality.
Exactly. And you see, even though it made no rational sense, they still showed up and they played for Halloween. And you're the guy who was just bad-mouthing Christmas. You can't lie to me.
Well, I wasn't bad-mouthing Christmas. I was bad-mouthing people spending when they don't have money.
While you're lauding your parents for buying full-size candy bars, something
that
probably impacted the lives of children throughout your community.
Come
there
on.
Are probably Supreme Court justices who got their start when they got a full-size candy bar at your house.
That can
be
true.
And here you're going to say that people should skimp on Christmas just because they feel like our economic system is a scam.
Right.
Well, I say, good sir, that I believe in the children, and we're going to be just fine.
All right. Take on a lot of debt. Spend money you don't have. Otherwise, you hate children. You heard it from Jeff Mackey, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to end on that note. Mackie, thanks so much for coming on, brother. It was a pleasure to meet you in Vegas in person. And let's do
good
this
times.
Again. We'll do this after Christmas when we both sober up, maybe February or something, and we both come to. And
we can have a much more somber episode after the crash happens, and I can explain how sheepish and embarrassed I am that I didn't see it coming.
Exactly, while chugging leftover eggnog.
Yeah, damn, didn't see this one coming.
I know, it didn't have an expiration date on it. I guess it's okay, you know. Mackie, thanks so much for coming on, brother. Talk to you soon.
Sure thing, my man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye bye. That was the one, the only Jeff Mackie. Awesome to have him on, and it was great really meeting him in Vegas last month, this month, whatever. High quality person in person. Some people, you meet him in person, you don't really know how it's going to go. Mackie and I sat down, bought me a couple of drinks, and we had some great conversation. We just talked about life in general, and I knew that right there, he's a quality dude, and stoked to have him back on. Hope he's a recurring guest on here, because that's what we want. When people that are real. My man believes in what he believes in. He says what he says. He's an expert in retail. He doesn't, and he's a self-made man, extraordinarily successful, and he says whatever he wants. And on this podcast, that's exactly what we respect. All right. Thank you again to my patrons for making this podcast episode possible. Got a lot of other shit booked for the coming weeks, including, well, maybe. We'll see. We'll see down the road, but there is a possibility that some things could happen eventually. All right. For now, I am the fuck out of here. Peace.